Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves and today we are talking, we're going back to the north, but it's kind of the north, we're in the north, it's like that babushka doll. And speaking of someone who should be shipped off to a gulag, Martin, how are you keeping?
I'm just back from the gulag, Tony, feeling fresh for it, I have to say.
You actually look as healthy as I've seen you in a long time and it has me depressed. I'm feeling my age and you're enjoying the summer. What's the secret? Is it just because you're just loving all the misery on Twitter?
No, just stock up on blood at night and then you can walk around during the day. I think that works for me, Tony.
Yeah. Those necks won't drain themselves. Right, anyway, enough talking nonsense. We are actually delighted to be joined via Zoom by a published author, and I refer to him as a historian. He's also a man of wears many hats, Tony Doherty. He's written some brilliant books, guys, and I've only finished the first one, and I've started the second one yesterday. Tony, thanks so much for taking time to talk to us.
Oh, you're welcome. You're very welcome, Tony and Martin.
Listen, I don't know. I know where I want to start with this. So I want to start with the fact that there's been a renewed interest in the Free State, shall we say, in events in the north since someone threw a petrol bomb at a bus. Now, we've been covering it for quite a while on the podcast, but we've been covering it a lot more in depth. And it strikes me that as a dairy man and as a someone who has a lot more to say on this, Tony, how have you found the interest from the south over the last number of weeks and months? Have you seen an upsurge in genuine interest, or is it just more of the macabre that we were only interested when things are somehow sensationalist?
I suppose I'm old enough to sort of realize that nothing lasts forever, no matter how good and no matter how bad. I would imagine that the revisionists in academia and the media in the South probably at one stage thought this is a wrap, this is basically a done deal, and it'll never emerge in any way beneficial, I suppose, to that sort of Northern nationalist story. But as I say, nothing lasts forever, folks. Empires come and go. Strong states come and go. Propaganda comes and goes. And the North, in a sense, is now sort of in the midst of a renewed opportunity, I suppose, in terms of the possibility of making change throughout the island, and in terms of the south of Ireland probably needs a peace process by this stage of the game, and in the south now you have a very sort of right left split, very very clearly defined, and as much defined as it's ever been since the foundation of the state. Mm-hmm. And in a sense, it's no bad thing. If you had asked me 10 years ago, would that be the case? I would have been extremely doubtful, but there you go. But from a northern point of view, I suppose there has been a bit of a renaissance and renewed interest in things north of the border, and it gives people a sort of different opportunity in this era to explain things to a younger southern audience who've never been exposed to northern stories, northern people, northern history before, because it's all been brushed onto the carpet. Literally, the carpet is quite a bulky place to be nowadays.
Well, you've written three books on the subject, and they are memoirs in effect. They tell the story of from literally from you going to get a hearing test all the way through to, you know, you getting arrested as a member of the IRA. You all of these things that you've actually gone through in your own life. And again, the dialect is very much of your era. It's Derry. It's pure. This is why I refer to you as a historian, because I believe it's an oral history of the events of the time, and I think it's really powerful. Can I ask you, beyond in those stories, the how your personal story, your family story, there's one really interesting point that was in it. And I think it's early enough, and it's maybe quarter of the way through the first book, where you talk about the fact that there is no purity of, tribe. Yeah. And I think that's a really important thing for everybody to understand that there's no, it wasn't just, there was, despite what everybody thinks, intermingling, shall we put it?
Yeah, quite a bit of intermingling, legal or illegal, whatever way it happens. I mean, when I grew up, there were shadows in our family, and I was never sure what they represented, but I knew that there was that Protestant blood along the line somewhere. He just picked that up from the ether. And I also knew that there was British Army blood along the line as well. And I, as I say, I wasn't sure where that came from. And the two are separate. As it turned out, there is Presbyterian blood in both sides of my family, my mother's family and my father's family. And my mother's family, the family story is that two sisters by the name of McTaggart left Donegal in about 1850, walked to Derry and eventually met two brothers. I think they came to Derry, they took the boat to America or whatever, but they settled in Derry and married two brothers by the name of Quigley. And there's a lot of Quigley families in Derry now as a result of that. So I found that out because a lollipop man stopped me in the street one day not long after I got out of jail. Actually, had told me the story, and I couldn't believe it. But then when I was writing my first book, I had to go and talk to my father's sister, my Aunt Maureen, who's probably about 82 or so now, because Derry people stop you and tell you your family history, whether you want them to stop you or not.
Just going to stop the podcast there, and it's the old deal. Show us the money. We're putting out this work. We need to be able to fund it, to get it out there. Now, the only way we're going to do that is with patrons. If you're listening and you have a few bob, you kind of owe it to pay back, don't you? So become a patron. Patreon.com/tortoiseshack. That's just it, really, Tony, isn't it?
Yeah, no, it's quite simple. But I will say, and I know this sounds really funny, you get a lot for your money. For your couple of quid, you get a consolidated feed. So all of the podcasts on the platform come to you in one feed, wherever your player is. You won't miss one. You'll be able to get all your favorite pods in one place. And you get actual invitations to the live online pods that we do, our Sunday show. We're coming up on our 45th live Sunday show, Martin. And the guests we've had have been extraordinary. The audience is always so engaging, so active. So look, if you enjoy what we do, help us keep going. It's that simple. We are truly independent. Like there's no ads, there's no sponsors, there's nobody in the background, there's no sugar daddy. You know, we need people to put their hands in their pocket to keep this platform running, because it is a platform. It's become a hub for so many other stories that wouldn't necessarily get out there. And you can help us keep going. Patreon.com/tortoiseshack. We let you go back to your podcast now. Thank you.
I mean, people and Derry people stop you and tell you your family history, whether you want them to stop you or not. And there's an old man, Barney McFadden, used to stop me all the time. Barney would have been an old Sinn Féiner before there was practically any Sinn Féiners, going back as far as you can go. And he used to say to me, he said, your granny was Cassie McFrederick, and her family were from Calais out the road. And I grand, Barney, great, nice story and all the rest of it, but I never really thought about it. Once you start writing about your family, you have to think about these things. You just can't be flippant and say, this is that, and so on and so forth. You have to sort of dig down
Especially when you have 23 brothers and sisters. Like,
absolutely. Well, I don't have 23 brothers.
I know. But I just, it really struck me reading that, you know, your aunt who was 3 years younger than you, and you're going, I thought in terms of my family, and I know on certain sides of my family, yeah, that would have been the case as well. Big Irish families, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. So anyway, to cut a long story short, I knew there was not only Presbyterian blood in the family, but there was also British Army blood in the family, and I had to get it right. So I went to my aunt, and she was able to tell me that her mother, who would have been my grandmother, was born Presbyterian, married a Catholic, and then her. Then actually, I got the story, went home, and was telling my wife the story, and the phone rang, and it was my aunt Maureen again, and she says, did you know that your grandfather? She said, I was poking around in my purse after you left. She says, and I found this card, and she says, do you know that your grandfather was killed in the British Army during the First World War? And that was the shadow that came out, the substance came out of the shadow. I had a clue really about about the actual detail of the connection, but she was able to tell me that he was killed in August 1916 in Flanders. Mm. And so, actually, Maureen, my aunt Maureen herself, she married Doherty, so was married Doherty, Maureen Doherty. And at one stage, actually in the 1970s, going into the 80s, she had two sons, two daughters, and her husband in prison.
Okay.
And then her own son, Danny, who was one of the people in prison at that time, he was executed by the SAS in 1984. So she was from a very, she is a sort of matriarch of a very Republican family. So she knew what she was passing on to me in terms of the British Army connection as well. Because my great-grandfather was killed as a member of the British Army. His great-grandson was killed by the British Army on Bloody Sunday. You know, so that's there's no purity in blood when it comes to Ireland or practically any modern country for that matter.
No.
It's a tapestry.
And now that you see, you know, you understand we have a shared history, and that's everybody on this island has a shared history. And with the changes you've seen down south in the last 10 years, do you have more hope now for the north of Ireland than you've had before?
Well, see, I think that there's a, I think there's a thing on us as Irish people. I mean, when you think of Palestine, only the Nutters support Israel. Let's be frank, and practically any of the political parties, there's. I think that there is something. I think there's a collective. There's something collective in us about the colonial experience, and the colonial experience comes right up to the famine, around dispossession, all that sort of trauma, right into the 70 years later with the Easter Rising and the War of Independence and so on. I think that is still in us. I think we are born rebels. Sometimes it's beaten out of us by the time we're fit to do anything about it. Sometimes it's not. And I think now we're living in a time of rebellion. I think we're living in a time of social rebellion, which I think is fantastic. There's nothing worse than youth that's wasted in conservatism. Youth, by its nature, really should be vibrant, dynamic, and rebellious. So I think it's fantastic that the young people of Ireland are seeing things differently than their parents and their grandparents, and they're no longer living under the dark shadow of Section 31 to put them off contemplating anything north of the border. So I think all that, I think we're, you know, and in a sense, we're really only reaping the benefit of the peace process 25 years later. And these things take time to gestate. nothing happens straight away.
Nothing happens straight away, and then sometimes things happen very quickly. And, you know, we've seen with events whereby the accelerant to a lot of these conversations has been the Brexit vote, and that's basically an English problem on the island of Ireland in many ways, that has sped up things. But I'm struck by a couple of things that you've said. One, in terms of the idea, because I've read a lot of stuff that you've spoken about, and I don't know, I can't remember, but I think it was someone, it might have been Confucius, who said, you know, if you go out looking for revenge, dig two graves. Because, yeah, you know, because that's, you've never had that in anything that in because you're like, you might not say it, but you've been involved in helping to set up the Justice for the Bloody Sunday campaign, the Free Derry Museum, and the Pat Finucane Centre. You strike me as a man who's done a lot of work in terms of building facing the trauma, looking at our history, and actually in that legacy. Now maybe we're more ready to listen than when we were when you were doing all of these endeavors though at that time. How do you feel about that, Tony?
Well, we can do a lot in 58 years, Tony. I've never been one to sort of lie under and hold my head in either shame or desperation. My first act of revenge, and I freely admit it in a sense, is that I joined IRA when I was 17. And, you know, I have no sense of shame whatsoever over doing that. Very much, I'm of the generation that joined the IRA because of the tyranny of the state. You know, when you were growing up in Derry in the early 1970s, it was a tyrannical state. No matter what way you look at it now, that wasn't spoken about very much after the early 1970s south of the border. But it's certainly spoken about now, because I think that tyrannical history, that period of history that existed from 1968 right through to the mid-70s is sort of seeping out, that all this sort of stuff is coming out of the shadows. The Ballymurphy inquest, the Bloody Sunday case, the Stardust. I mean, you look at the resilience of the human spirit. I mean, you just have to look at the families of the Stardust fire in 1981. They witnessed that. And when it comes to it, I think you have two choices. One, that you live with a decision to do nothing, which is very, very difficult to live with in my book. Or you decide there is something that I can do, either on my own or with others. So I'm sort of, in terms of writing, that's a very sort of lonely pastime. The political and human rights development is essentially a collaborative project. So you're right, I've been involved since I was released from prison, actually, in 1985, with the Bloody Sunday family setting up the campaign. We set up the Pat Finucane Centre. And all those things, I think, have come to fruition over the years. But there are things that had to be done at that time. Maybe if I hadn't done it, somebody else would have come along a few years later. But the fullness of the role of the Pat Finucane Centre or the Bloody Sunday campaign wasn't evident to us at the time. It was one of those sort of intuitive things that I and ours felt we needed to do, and the benefit of that will probably come out in some sort of distant
just for the future. I'm sorry to cut in, but just for listeners' benefit, tragedy struck your door, like right in your on your family's doorstep. So, I mean, when you refer to the Bloody Sunday, your father lost his life on that day.
Yeah.
So for you to say that, you know, your first act of revenge was, you know, at 17 to join the IRA. But I've also read you say that you don't have that hate in your heart anymore.
Yeah. I suppose age brings different things with it as well. When I was 17 or 15, 16 or 10 or 11, for that matter, as far as I was concerned, that there was only one way you could get back. I mean, and there's nothing really peculiar to me saying that. I mean, that's a story of humankind since we started on this planet. But yes, I did lose my father. He was murdered on Bloody Sunday. I walked past the place where he was killed every day. So, and Derry, as I wrote in my third book, The Scalper and I, you literally do walk past your history every day and the week. You know, they do your shopping, they go and meet friends up the town and so on. One of the things about it that I am always now quick to remind people when you look at loss and the due process under the criminal justice system and so on and so forth, there was never a policeman came to our door. Never a single policeman came to our door after Bloody Sunday. And do you see anybody who was killed by the state? It would be a rarity for a policeman to darken the door looking for evidence to inform them that their loved one had been killed, to provide pastoral care, God forbid, from the RUC, or any of that sort of stuff. That just did not happen. And literally, the state left ourselves and many hundred of our families to their own devices. And what we actually found out during the Ballymurphy inquest is that because there was no investigation, there was no criminal investigation, so that sort of that a criminal investigation is a high bar, it's a high threshold. Because of that, it has basically made prosecutions for those hundreds of people that were killed by the state virtually impossible. That's something that people I think now are starting to realize, that the criminal conviction is a high bar that requires evidence. On many occasions there is no evidence whatsoever because there was no investigation. So I sort of grew up with that as a child. I mean, I didn't really work it all out, but you sort of knew that what the British were saying about Bloody Sunday, about coming around, about as a result of a gun battle, your father was either caught in crossfire or a gunman, we're not too sure. Hundreds of families like ours were left in the exact same position of this, the state basically taking our my father away and all the other men and boys away, and leaving nothing in terms of due process or any of that. And that's why it took years. As a matter of fact, if there hadn't been for a peace process, there would be no talk of justice at all, because that's not how it works.
But you're not, as you said, it's hard to get justice after so much time. It's practically impossible. So what's the alternative? If you can't get justice, what is it that people need? Is it reconciliation? Is it to tell their stories? Is it to have their history validated?
It's probably a discrete sort of mixture of all that. And the difficulty for us here north of the border is that the British government holds quite a lot of the cards. The British government was a player in the conflict. They were combatants in the conflict. So they sort of have no right to dictate that we should do this or we should do that, or would we consider this or consider that. I've thought for long years that there needs to be an international process of truth and reconciliation, not dissimilar from what happened in South Africa, but maybe not exactly that either. But the where all the state all the players, whether state, pro state or anti state, would put their cards on the table for the benefit of all those who were killed, all those who were lost during the conflict. And I think that's really the only way we're going to ever resolve this. And I think it's a mixture of people having their loss acknowledged, people having their injustice acknowledged, people looking for facts about why and how their loved ones were killed. All that, I think all those things are all valid.
I think that's really, really important that you laid it out. But I also reminded of very recently, and I don't know if you, I'm sure you saw it yourself, the report in the mother and baby home scandal in Ireland and how those victims were treated. And we've had Noelle Brown on, who was born in a mother and baby home several times. She's been a brilliant contributor to the podcast, whether it was on the Sunday shows, whatever. And she uses the same phrase over and over, and it's delay, deny, and wait for me to die.
Yeah,
because there's an element of that, Tony, whereby the state admitting their liability also opens themselves up to all sorts of other, you know, forms of recompense, forms of, yeah. I mean, there are claims only, like, I think in the last few days of I think it's Belgium paying recompense to some of its former colonies. It is a new story that they're trying to work out a deal with former colonies. So when you think of it in that context, we're probably, you said we've had the 25 years since the Good Friday Agreement. We're probably still another 25 years, if not more, away from some of this. And I say this from a someone who's sitting in a four bedroom house in Dublin. We sit in here, look at even in terms of our police force and the issues that we have in terms of, you know, how it became overnight our police force and not the British state's police force, yeah. Some of those things. I mean, we've covered that as well on the podcast. Can I ask you though, reasons to be positive? And I'm conscious of that as like we spoke to Colin Harvey from Queens, and he's involved the Shared Island project. And yeah. I felt so optimistic after coming off the chat with him, because he was so, he didn't want the naysayers, the doomsdayers and all of that to get in the way of the fact that there was an opportunity here. And that was the words you used about 20 minutes ago, an opportunity here to get a lot of things right that we got wrong 100 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, all those things that you mentioned, Tony, whether it's the Belgian government, whether it's the British government pissing up the slavery, all those things, those are all the sort of huge wrongs of history that have helped create the world and all the injustice within it. It hasn't just come about by accident. You know, all these things they all happen over long processes of time. But by the same token, I would be very optimistic. We all have our own family or personal crosses to bear, literally, at times. But I've never been one to allow my own sort of personal tragedy to stand in front of or against political progress or human rights process. I mean, families could have banged the table as the Republicans were negotiating with the British to bring about peace. We could have banged the table and says, you know, it's no justice without no peace without justice, but we didn't, because there is a bigger picture there. I think in contemporary terms, I think that there has never been a greater opportunity, and it doesn't just come from one source. I think there's a whole series of things going on. I think Brexit is an opportunity. Which the right wing in Britain, to their shame, some of the people in the middle ground in Britain and unionists in the north, by and large, fought for. They saw this as their sort of self-determination in a sense. I think that there is something going on among the younger population of the island, which I think is fantastic. I think that unionism appears to be in meltdown, and unionism is, I mean, I don't want to sound belligerent or nothing, but I don't think that unionism has very much to offer the people of the North. Or as a matter of fact, it might offer some people in the South a greater opportunity than they do up here.
What does the older generation have to offer the younger generation by way of guidance of bringing them through this period, the post-Brexit period? What is it that the older generation have experienced, everything that's gone on up north? What did they have to offer to the younger generation coming forward?
I suppose that one of the things that they have to offer, Martin, is having lived through the long war in the north. I describe the 1970s as dark days, and right under the 1980s with the hunger strike. And I suppose there was a lot of terrible things that happened. There was a lot of bravery. There was a lot of people who went to prison. There were massacres by the British army, by the loyalists, by the IRA. You know, I'm a former member of the IRA. I'm not claiming that our hands are clean as such. But it was the totality, I think, of the longevity of the conflict, I think, has made our generation clear, I suppose, in terms of mind, that there should be no going back to any possibility of armed conflict. I think you sort of get that on the loyalist side as well, but to be frank about it, there's not many nefarious sort of
agitators.
You wouldn't be too hopeful that it's going to end up good or wholesome.
Some of the best conversations, Tony, we had was we had Kula Yasoma, the she's the commissioner for young people and children in Northern Ireland, and she was talking about the fact that, you know, the kids throwing missiles and I say missiles loosely. Stones and rocks. They've more in common on the Shankill and the Falls than they do with the people who are agitating to get them out there doing it, you know. And it's, I suppose, what we're kind of trying to focus on is the hope that there is that there's actually a possibility of a shared Ireland that means social mobility, better educational attainment, more employment opportunities, and actually, you know, okay, there's a hard core of, I think it was Emma D'Souza yesterday told us, Martin, it's about 120,000. It's about 150,000 people, you know, hardcore DUP sort of voters, kind of thing. And can we amplify them to the point whereby in all the debates that we say, oh, it's 50-50. We have to have their voice equal to the other, you know, 5.8 million people on the island. And it doesn't seem to tally with an idea of how we move forward for the greater good of all. And I mean, including that cohort who may not want to come along on the journey that I hope leads to my island being reunited.
Yeah, and I suppose we're back to that word opportunity as well. And I do think that there is a genuine and probably unprecedented opportunity for political change on the island, north and south, and whatever bit comes in between. I do take the point about it's 50% plus one. That's the way it's written in to the Good Friday Agreement. However, I also think that that any sort of change to the constitutional status, as it were, needs to be explored in its fullness, in terms of the new political institutions, if they ever come about. I think that there are huge benefits. I think there's actually benefits for Southern Ireland in terms of the possibility of having a National Health Service, for instance. But I do think what we shouldn't do is rush after the 50% plus one, because you could see that could be a recipe for disaster. So all these things, I think, need to be given time. If there was to be a transitional period, it could be as long as 10, 15 years. It could be transitional, and it could move forward sort of piece by piece.
Oh, we could go, like Colin made the suggestion that you might end up with federalism for a while or whatever the idea, but I pushed back and I said we cannot allow Cork that sort of independence, but nonetheless we just don't I get that we're on a road and I think people need to be patient and understand that, but I do think the accelerant was the Brexit vote. It was the accelerant.
Oh, there's no doubt. I think unionism has been hung by its own petard, and I think I think that there is an element within unionism which is progressive, and that they saw the opportunity of the benefits of the European Union being squandered, and went against it. That's the first time ever that unionism has, or a significant section of unionism hasn't gone along with the unionist sort of traditional vote. So I think that is a cultural break, which will probably prove really significant.
It could be a cultural chasm, Tony, really and truly. It could be a cultural chasm. It may lead to more moderate loyalists taking up the reins. At the moment, it's extremists, and I don't say that lightly. I mean, the DUP is extremist.
Well, as Emma said to us yesterday, the rhetoric from Edwin Poots has been the language of war.
Yeah, absolutely, 100%. So, I mean, there is an opportunity there, and I think moderate loyalists are moderate in all senses. They don't want to go back. No more than the nationalist side wants to go back. They certainly don't want to go back. I think there's a real opportunity there to build a better unionism.
There probably is, and unionism is going to be with us for a long, long time to come, if not forever. So I think that the institutions of the state within Ireland need to manifest themselves so that they respect that and reflect that. I'm not saying we all become sectarian overnight or nothing like that, but I mean, you get what I mean. You just can't have a 32-county socialist republic when you have quite a rump of people north of the border and quite a rump of people south of the border as well.
You would
die in the ditch against a socialist republic. But no, I think they're very interesting times. I think I think unionism is in a very, very volatile position. One thing is clear to me about the state of unionism in the last 20-odd years since the signing of the Good Friday Agreement, and that is the orange state has gone. We don't have the orange state anymore in terms of the pillars of the state being the political control, the political institutions, the police force, and so on. All those things have all been whittled down and democratized significantly over the last 20 years. The PSNI, for all their stupidity here and there, are not the RUC. Now, you may see manifestations here and there of the old RUC, for instance, the events in the Lower Armour Road there, not so long ago, outside Graham's Bookies, but the RUC is gone, and the unionism's ownership of police of the police is also gone, and that's been something that has been with us since the foundation of the Northern State, gone completely. So unionism will reflect on this very, very carefully. They don't have the political or the military strength that they used to have. And I think that's one of the things that I think will sober them up before they start calling on the troops to go over the top in the way that they have in the past. I think there's great cause for optimism. That's not to say it's going to be easy at all, far from it. But bring it on.
I think that's an optimistic note to leave it on, Tony.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for coming on and having this chat with us, and we'll hope to have a chat with you again in the future. best of luck with everything. Keep working away. And 58 is not that old, Tony. Trust me.
No. And when I take the Nobel Prize for Literature, I'll come back and I might just give you an hour interview.
Listen. I'm actually going to translate your book into written English as opposed to Derry English. You know. It was the colloquialisms that I loved so much. Yeah. That was what I loved about it. But no, me I would too. Go check them out, listeners. I'll put the link in the blog. There you can get them on your Kindle on Apple. If you're in a hurry, just grab them on that, because that's what I did. I would very much recommend it. Real eye opener, and actually a lot of stuff I could kind of relate to as I see those big Catholic families as well. Tony Doherty, I really appreciate taking the time to talk to us. And just so listeners know, we'll be back very shortly. We're going back to Gaza, funnily enough, Tony, to talk to Hannah Salah about the situation since the ceasefire has taken hold. We will talk to you all very soon. It's patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Talk to you again. Bye-bye.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony.